Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the producer and host of today's podcast, and I am pleased to have Esther E. Hernandez, Alicia Yvonne Estrada, and Karina Alvarado with me to discuss their co-edited volume, U.S. Central Americans, Reconstructing Memories, Struggles, and Communities of Resistance, published by the University of Arizona Press in 2017. Esther Hernandez is Associate Professor of Chicana and Chicano and Latino Studies at CSU Los Angeles. Her work focuses on Central Americans, evolving identities, community formation, and social and economic adaptations. She has published in the Journal of American Ethnic History and Economy and Society, and also serves on the Executive Board of the Coalition for Human Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles. Alicia Yvonne Estrada is Associate Professor of Chicana and Chicano Studies at CSU Northridge. Her research focuses on Maya cultural productions in Guatemala and the U.S., and she has published in Romance Notes, Latino Studies, and Revista Canadiense de Estudios Hispanos. She is also a collaborator with the Maya radio program Contacto Ancestral on KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. And Karina Alvarado is a visiting lecturer in the Cesar E. Chavez Chicano and Chicana Studies program at UCLA. Her work centers on intercultural and gendered Latino and Latina narratives, cross-textual representations of Latinidad, and U.S. Central American transnational cultural reproductions. She has published in Studies in 20th and 21st Century Literature, Latino Studies, and ISTMO Denison. All right, I think I got all that right, so you guys can correct me if that's wrong, but I want to welcome everyone to New Books in Latino Studies. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Okay, so to begin, how about we take a minute or two? I'd like each of you to just briefly introduce yourselves to our audience, maybe share something a little bit about your personal and professional background. Perhaps we can begin with Esther and then proceed with Alicia and Karina.
Thank you. Esther Hernandez, and I'm actually now full professor at Cal State LA. So I'm in the Department of Chicano Latino Studies, and I grew up in El Salvador until the age of 12, and then my family reunited with my mother here in the United States in 1981. So I grew up in L.A., initially in the Pico Union area, but basically we moved to Mid-City, and I went to Los Angeles High School. So I, you know, sort of was in the center of L.A. No, I'm just kidding. I graduated from Los Angeles High School, and I went to UC Irvine, where I did my master's and my PhD.
I'm Alicia Estrada. Just like Esther, I just got promoted to full professor, too. I came to Los Angeles in 1981 when I was 8 years old from Guatemala. My dad was a fireman, and he initially migrated in 1977 to New York and then Chicago. And then, by 1980, the civil war in Guatemala was at its height, or beginning its height. And so the move was supposedly temporary. And we moved to Los Angeles because for my father, it was sort of closest to the weather in the coast. He didn't want us to have to endure the winters of Chicago and of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in Westlake MacArthur Park. That's where we lived for a bit over a decade. And then we moved to Highland Park, where I reside now. And back before it was gentrified, Highland Park also had a Guatemalan community. There were, you know, Guatemalan bakeries, there were Guatemalan stores, and my parents liked that. And of course, we all know that then gentrification came in, and those were some of the first businesses that were shut down. I left to UC San Diego, and I worked with Rosaura Sanchez and Jorge Mariscal there. And there were the folks who really sort of told me about graduate school. I didn't really know about it as first generation. And I knew I wanted to write about Guatemala. I knew I wanted to write about, you know, people that I was very close to from you know, that were friends and relatives of the Maya community. And so I left to UC Santa Cruz. And then I came back to finish my dissertation, and I was invited to lecture at CSUN. And then I ended up just kind of, you know, staying at CSUN on a tenure track position. And I've been there since 2003 when I was a grad student and I was lecturing, and then 2006 when I got hired.
So hello, my name is Karina Oliva Alvarado. And currently, well, I've been for the last 5 years at UCLA in the Chicano Studies Department. And what's really exciting about that is that I was asked to develop four classes around U.S. Central American topics. And so I've been able to, or I designed four classes, one on racial constructions, looking at the diversity in Central America, because oftentimes with Central America, we typify it as a mestizo nations or a region of mestizo nations, erasing all of its diversity. And so we began there looking at the diversity within Central America. And then, of course, as it relates to the diasporas in the United States, I also developed a class on cultural production. And that is because I truly believe in the Chicano statement of La Cultura Cura. And so we look at artists, we look at different forms of cultural production, film, music, food practices, and how they inform Central American identity, but then also how they help a community stay connected to their heritage from Central America. And so looking at different forms of assimilation, for example, and it's kind of like a process of discovery for many of the students. My last class I designed was on literature. Now, I also am Salvadoran immigrant. I came to the United States at a young age when I was 5 years old. And I think that I typify the experience of Central American immigrants. My first point of entry was the Union and Westlake, and I grew up there. I grew up there until the age of 18. And then I, as a young adult, that's when I moved out into other areas like San Gabriel and El Monte, South El Monte, West Covina, etc. So my identity is still kind of the formative, right, experience that I had was actually in people union. And so I got to witness its transformation from the time that it had only like El Gatecito restaurant was the only Salvadoran restaurant you could go to across MacArthur Park to now where it's a hub, right? It's a hub for Central Americans. I didn't go to school or to college until a late age. I had focused on, I typify the experience of immigrants, I believe. And so I was working class, just very focused on labor and on family and on my domestic work, etc. And meaning as a mother and as a parent and as a wife. And so I didn't return to school until a late age. And I often like to tell my students that I was a transfer student from East Los Angeles Community College. This actually empowers them. And then I transferred to UC Berkeley. And at UC Berkeley, I was following a trajectory of literature. I mean, I love the humanities. But I also went through a process of self-discovery as I read African-American literature, Chicano literature, I began to ask, where is U.S. Central American? Where are the U.S. Central American writers? And so that led me then to my PhD. And so that is what the focus of my PhD in ethnic studies at UC Berkeley was, the comparative look at Chicano literature and U.S. Central American.
Well, thank you, each of you, for those introductions. And it sparked my curiosity in regards to how the this book came together. I'm not sure if one of you took the lead, but could you explain that process about how this collection eventually came together from start to finish?
I think it was a collective venture. We were all working, or our community is working around the same topic, same issues, exploring it, of course, through our own perspectives and angles, etc. And we had already been in conversation for a few years, right, Alicia and Esther, in regards to our work. So if one of you wants to follow through with that, I mean, our conversations.
We've had several conversations about our classes, both at conferences, but I think the point where this anthology sort of started taking shape was we used to meet at the Homegirl Cafe, and you know, it was sort of a midpoint for all of us, and so we would meet there, and that's where we started sort of shaping how the anthology would, you know, sort of the focus and, you know, how we envisioned the anthology itself. But it was through a number of formal and informal conversations. But I think that the more formal conversations happened, you know, while enjoying food at the Homegirl Cafe and exchanging experiences, both in terms of our teaching, but also in terms of our research. I don't know, Esther, if you want to, you know, add something else.
Yeah, I agree. We, you know, like projects come together and sometimes we don't include certain stories. And one of our main stories was that we did meet at Homegirl Cafe many times and began to map out how we're going to get this project completed. And I think a lot of it was around teaching, because we do teach a lot of Central American Studies classes. We usually teach not too many, and now Karina has developed several of them. But usually programs have one or two classes, unless, of course, at CSUN. But, you know, in most campuses, the practice is that there's one or two classes and they're very disciplinary based. And we all come from interdisciplinary backgrounds, I think. I mean, I think Karina and Alicia definitely more literature. I am a social scientist, and I have been interested in looking at families and the economic survival strategies among families. So that was my research as a social science anthropology student in my PhD program. So we had these conversations, right, because it was part our experience as immigrants ourselves, and also the struggle of teaching about the region and teaching about the realities of Central Americans in L.A. primarily. We did focus primarily in L.A., but we do have contributions from San Francisco and other areas. But I think the experience of being an immigrant in Los Angeles is really fundamental to who we are as Central Americans and our efforts to nurture our backgrounds, right? Because Alicia is Guatemalan and like we're Salvadoran, and sort of like having these conversations across the table, right, about what it means to be Centroamericanas in predominantly Mexicano and Chicano environments. And so we definitely developed a sisterhood around, you know, the issues that we're facing as academics of working class backgrounds, you know, in the multiple intersectionalities that we're dealing with on an everyday basis and in our classrooms. Right. So definitely that's where it all began, I think.
Exactly. Well, I was just going to say on that, if you want to add to this as we going, because we're getting to the next part of the question I wanted to go towards, which is particularly the gap in the scholarship, not just in Latino studies broadly, but that's an important one, right, too, but also within the scholarship on U.S. Central Americans. You started to allude to that, you know, already, but can you speak specifically to, you know, what this collection adds to both of those literatures?
So I think one of the things that that we wanted to address specifically is the voices of scholars that are, you know, considered 1.5 or second generation, right? That's part of the gap that we wanted to address in the anthology. And of course, the anthology as a starting point, right? Not necessarily as a complete response or a solution, but in fact, I think the idea of the anthology is to, you know, to generate more discussion, and obviously there are gaps in the anthology, right? We don't have works by people who are, you know, writing about or thinking about Honduras, right, or Nicaragua or Costa Rica or Belize for that matter. So very much as a starting point, but very much coming from both the, you know, the experiences, but also the framing and the thinking and the scholarship of 1.5 and second generation. So in the anthology, you see the works of, you know, Floribo Lopez, you know, who writes about second generation Mayans, for instance, right? And I think the engagement with Latinidad or Latino studies is one that hopes to also expand the way that we think about Latinidad and the ways in which Latinidad tends to also function as, to erase other experiences and to some extent and identities. And to some extent, you know, my contribution in the article also points to the need for us to think about how Mayas may not necessarily identify and often don't as Central Americans, right? So as we are also talking about and engaging with U.S. Central American experiences or Centroamericanismos, as you know, Maritza Cardenas points to, we also need to be attuned with the ways in which these identities or these affiliations may also reproduce or erase other communities, like, you know, Mayas, Garifunas, and you know, other communities in Central America or in the diaspora that may or may not embrace or feel that they are included in these identities.
Anything you want to add, Esther?
Well, I think, you know, you asked in terms of like, what are the contributions that we do to U.S. Latinidad? I think that, you know, we confront this in our classrooms. Oftentimes when we talk about Latinidad, there tends to be an emphasis on Mexican, Puerto Rican, and Cuban. And that was a frustration, obviously, for us as, you know, the second largest group in California in particular, but definitely in other places like D.C. And Texas, right, where the community is growing. And also we're growing in the South, right? Like, people are moving to other areas of the country and initiating new clusters in those communities. And I think that, you know, a lot of the contributions that we saw in the major contributions, for example, the contribution on citizenship by Susan Oboler, it doesn't include a discussion about a particularly Central American experience, and also about the experience of Salvadorans in particular, who have been sort of like in this limbo status for more than 30 years now. And I think that, you know, that is a major gap that we contribute to, because we want to speak not only about the reasons why we migrated, but also our experience within the U.S. context, right, within the political and economic context of the U.S. And that hasn't been addressed. And I think, again, our anthology is a conversation about, you know, who we are as people, humanizing our experiences. And it definitely doesn't cover all the topics that we should be talking about. So we hope to see a growth of different themes, like, you know, talking about Latinidad, talking about cultural production, as Karina said, which is very exciting. And we started in our anthology, right? We have Yahaira Padilla, who was looking at art in the construction of Latinidad, right, from a Centroamericano perspective, right? Or in terms of U.S. Central Americans, again, I want to reinforce what Alicia said about, we really wanted to look at the 1.5 generation that we're part of, right, and that has this bridge to build between our communities in Central America and here in the United States. And it was very exciting to engage in dialogue with Alicia regarding the Maya experience, right? Because when we talk about Latinidad, we're immediately erasing a lot of realities, right, that are not encompassed by that term. But nonetheless, given the political context, we deploy it, right? We do stake our claim within Latinidad, but we understand that it definitely doesn't address the complexity of our citizenship, the complexity of our relationships to our home communities, and the ongoing struggles that we're dealing with. So I think, you know, again, it's sort of this exciting moment to engage in these conversations and dialogues and open up these capillaries, right? I mean, we're not like, there's a lot of work to do, and you know, this is our first effort, and we're very proud. And it was so exciting to share that with my colegas, Karina and Alicia, right? Who definitely we broke bread, and we just definitely talked about these issues of memory, these issues of silence in a lot of ways that we deal with. As academics and as members of communities that are highly marginalized, right? But that refuse to accept that space. So I think,
you know, we were really cognizant of the fact that we didn't want to reproduce hierarchies and erasures. And we did approach Nicaraguan and Honduran scholars to contribute, and meaning also beyond just Nicaraguan and Honduran scholars to contribute. But a lot of the work that we do in academia is about timing, and it is about how much time people have. And so, unfortunately, we were turned down when we requested work from Nicaraguan and Honduran scholars and others. And then there was an opportunity, a missed opportunity, very late in the game. This book took us 4 years to put together. And so it was just a couple of months into, like, we were going to be published soon, and we had already gone through, I believe, the proofs or the edits. And so then it was just really difficult to even consider adding on. And so, but like we've said, this is a point of entry. And I believe that the book is experimental in a sense, because I think even the press wasn't sure what the response was going to be. And what this book has shown is that the response is great. The need is great. I believe we are already in second printing, right, guys?
Yes. Yes. So
it's sold out, I mean, within a year's time. And so meaning that people want to learn about Central Americans. And as a point of entry, we are hoping that another anthology will emerge, will come forth, focusing on the other Central American countries and the other Central American diasporas here in the United States.
Yes, you know, on the reception, it's certainly something that, you know, I wasn't privy, of course, the information that it's on the second printing, so congratulations. But just in the institutions that I'm affiliated with, I see, you know, scholars and professors, you know, adapting it for their courses. Last year, myself, when I was constructing a course on Latino social movements in the U.S. as mostly a 20th century course, this book became, you know, a lifesaver in a way, as I really struggled, you know, to find, you know, recent work. And that was the goal of that class, and particularly really find the most recent scholarship on broadly Latino politics in the U.S. That, you know, connected with the Central American experience in the U.S. So just, you know, straight from me and my class. In particular, the other point I wanted to bring up is that it's not just, you know, scholars like yourselves, of course, that have recognize the absence of your own voices, but it's our students too, right? I mean, that's something that I didn't realize myself, you know, not identifying, not being Central American. The absence of that voice and that scholarship. And it took, you know, students, you know, really in ways, in a very loving way, you know, nudging me, critiquing me and say, you know, you need to continue to add and look harder to find more scholarship, you know, on Central Americans. I mean, I thought I did a pretty good, you know, job putting my class together and spent a lot of time, particularly looking for recent scholarship, you know, particularly to the Central American experience. But, you know, my students lovingly, you know, nudged me and said, you know, maybe we don't need 2 weeks anymore on Chicano politics. You know, maybe you can cut off a half a week or so and add a little bit more. So it's the students themselves is the point that I'm making. And we're all teaching in institutions in Southern California. So obviously this is the kind of epicenter concentration of a lot of that migration experience. But I'm sure, as already I received nudgings from other colleagues to say, hey, are you aware of this book? It needs to be on the podcast. So I too have been hearing it from multiple voices, right? From scholars, from students, both about the reception of this book and the need for scholarship just like
Thank
this.
Thank you. We appreciate that. And we appreciate the youth, definitely. They push us forward, right? I think one thing about the book that I think everyone's responding to is that it humanizes us, right? And it shows the world how it is we are a community, how we are living. For example, I love Alicia's article because it really emplaces you. It kind of makes you feel what Westlake feels like when you go to the mercado. And besides, of course, for very critical work dealing with race, class, gender. And so it's just, I think it's fabulous in that way that it's very critical and yet also gives you a sense of people, of community, of lives, of the embodied experience.
Would each of you mind, and each of you have a contribution, a single, your own authored article or chapter within the collection on top of, collaborating both on the introduction and the conclusion as well as the broader organization of the book. So the book is organized, the collection is organized in two parts, right? The first part is generational oral histories of education and gendered labor and resistance literature. Karina, you have a chapter in that section. Would you like just to summarize a bit of what that chapter is and how it fits into that section, and then we can go to the next section with the work of Esther and
yeah.
Alicia.
Well, I coined these terms, Siwa narratives and gynecologies, and Siwa is the Nahuatl term for women, and gyne is actually a prefix for women, and so you'll find that gyne through various languages it means women, and so it's kind of being redundant a bit, saying women-centered narratives of women, basically. But it's a way to centralize the women's experiences, the Western Hemisphere. And of course, I'm looking in particular at the work of Leticia Hernandez Linares, poet, activist, organizer, just a truly phenomenal person from San Francisco. And so I look at her work, and through her work, through her poetry, I then explore Prudencia Ayala, which students love to learn about Prudencia Ayala because she was a Salvadoran woman who ran for the presidency in 1930 when women didn't have the right to vote, in Central America. And so we look at Prudencia Ayala, and we also look at La Sinaba, the legend of La Sinaba. And I think that my contribution at looking at the legend of La Sinaba is looking at her through a resistance. So not looking at her through hegemonically speaking, right, as just a symbol of domesticity and submissiveness of women, which Central American women tend to be typified as that, right, women who get raped, abused, etc., and rather look at her as a symbol of strength. So meaning that when these narratives are passed down, they pass down messages, encoded messages to the listener that depending on whether you're listening as hegemonically or counter-hegemonically, right, you're going to get a different message. And so I like to focus, especially my students, I like to focus my students on the messages of resistance, right, and empowerment of women.
Great. Okay. And so that fits within the first section. The first section is more of, it has oral histories and narratives in particular. It's focusing through that lens. I think the second part, a bit more on the cultural production side, and am I getting this right? Or in particularly in the way the volume is divided into those two sections. What's really that organizing, premise of the first section as opposed to the second one, which your work, Esther and Alicia, your two chapters are in there.
Yeah, I think you're right. In the first section, we try to look at the oral histories and look at sort of like the long history of our communities. And in the second part, we kind of looked at cultural production, and my contribution had to do with what was happening at Carecen, one of our hubs, right, of social movement activism and immigrant rights advocacy. And I kind of came into that space sort of looking for our narratives. And what I found was a narrative of the history of the war, a visual archive that was present there at that time. And it had photography, it had testimonials. And Judy Baca was basically doing a mural in there that still exists, right? Looking at the history of Central American migration. And so I came into it sort of looking at our memories and how we rescue those memories that are traumatic, right? And how we transform them into something that is very empowering. Within the space, I was able to then at that time meet Epicentro, which was a group of poets that was really speaking to the experience of the immigrant, the refugee, and, you know, sort of like the reality of living in Los Angeles in the late 90s. And so I think you're right. It sort of focuses on this cultural production that was taking place that it can be ephemeral, right? Because people don't necessarily go to Carece and to like, you know, do the things that I did at that time, which was go to this archive that was there at the time where people were donating photographs. They were donating political posters and stickers and things like that. And there were high school students, college students coming in and having dialogue about, you know, where we came from. And I was one of those. I was doing my PhD and I was one of those people engaging in conversations with multiple generations. And so it was a beautiful space in terms of what was going on. And at that time, also, Norma Chinchilla had finished her book on seeking community, right, in L.A. And so that was also part of, you know, the conversation taking place, you know, sort of like how we moved from our refugee period, right, to emplacing ourselves within Los Angeles and emplacing ourselves within the broader immigrant rights movement at the time.
So that section, I think, also is very invested in thinking about memory, right?
All this is the second one you're referring to?
This is the second, right. Yeah, the section where Esther's piece and my piece and the others are very much invested in thinking about memory and the way that memory is passed down to different generations. The way that memory is constructed publicly in Los Angeles, right? So my piece looks at these sort of also ephemeral sort of space of the, you know, the mercados that I call the form of, you know, of all these street vendors coming together. Yehaira's piece looks at the work of Caché and his murals throughout the Silver Lake area, in the mid-city area. And Maritza looks at the parades, right? The Central American parade. And Flori's work looks at the use of traje, right? Of regional dress by Maya women, both, you know, immigrant women, but also specifically focusing on second generation. So mm-hmm. how these different, you know, mediums help in constructing a form of memory, right? Whether these cultural memories or historical memories, some of them more ephemeral than others, but all of them sort of coming into this sort of public space, right? And claiming that space, literally, in my case, in my chapter, on the, you know, on the streets of Los Angeles, right? The chapter, of course, and my contribution comes from knowing that space incredibly well, because that's where I grew up. Those are the streets that I grew up in, that I continue to be a part. You know, I go there, even I live in Highland Park now, I go there regularly, and I have a lot of friends that participate, you know, in different ways, either by, you know, consuming things there or selling, being part of the vendors that sell or the business owners around the area. And it came also, you know, the chapter was thinking about also the ways in which under these very strict anti-immigrant laws, and particularly the layers of discrimination and racism that indisposability that particularly Maya, undocumented Maya immigrants face, there's different sort of strategies of survival that are employed. And those strategies of survival include some forms of mobility or accessing some types of mobility throughout the city. And so I also wanted to think about, just in thinking about the works on the Maya diaspora, oftentimes what has been published focuses on these more traditional forms of organizing and networking. So people organizing through church or through hometown associations. And I'm interested in thinking about other ways in which Maya is organized in Los Angeles. And so, you know, this space, the creation of this space that comes out, you know, organically for me is another example of creating networks, right? So in the chapter, I talk about how, you know, and I've, you know, witnessed this many, many times, how certain stores or certain vendors provide information, how the, you know, the light posts are places that, you know, advertise, you know, different ways of moving through either the city or the country, right? They provide taxis to go from Los Angeles to South Carolina or New York, right? They provide information about a housing. At one of the stores that I visit regularly, which was one of the first stores to sell Maya textiles for women, right? And now we see a lot more women wearing their textiles publicly, their trajes publicly. And Rodi's piece expands that that conversation. But one of the first stores that, you know, that began to sell those regional clothing specifically for the consumption of Maya women and children, you know, there's information about after school programs. And so they serve more than just businesses. They serve also a space for creating networks and a space for there to be a sense of community, very much like the ways that those spaces are created and become important in Guatemala. It also, you know, for me, it's also thinking about how those cultural practices, those social practices are part of a memory that are passed down through sort of embodied practice, right? That, you know, I see different generations that live in the area participating in, right? So not just the first generation that immigrates, but also the children that are that have been born in the United States that are part and that live in those communities or that live specifically in West Lake MacArthur Park. I mean, we have vendors throughout Los Angeles, and that's been part of the history of Los Angeles, right? And also the criminalization of those vendors has been part of the history of Los Angeles, but not in the same way that they concentrate in those, you know, in those in that part of LA, right? In those, you know, those couple of city blocks and on those days and the kinds of services that they provide for a community that it's incredibly marginalized, both in the context of the U.S., but also in the context of, you know, non-Indigenous immigrant communities. So the effort was, you know, to contribute and to think about other ways of memory, of creating a historical memory or memory, but also in thinking about different ways that step away from sort of traditional Western ways of thinking about organizing and creating community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the comments and the well, your comments about the contributions that focus particularly on memory, you know, and even the earlier, you know, section with oral histories and literature, you know, strike me as, you know, this effort, again, all this occurring mostly right in Los Angeles among 1.5 and second generation migrants, this effort to, you know, establish and preserve a history, you know, right, that also creates a basis of identity. Right? As I tell a lot of my students, you know, I'm a historian by training. And one of my favorite definitions of history is that it's the stories that we tell about ourselves to give ourselves a sense of identity, right? And that, you know, this is particularly, you know, pertinent, I think, to not only the broader Central American community, but in Los Angeles, a place that is so dominantly viewed as Mexicano or Chicano, right? So you see these, you know, the second half of the book focusing on these various types of cultural production, which are, again, efforts, you know, to establish a sense of history and to pass that on, right? These cultural practices, whether it's, you know, through, you know, weavings or, right, textile type of like work or public art, things of that sort, right, that are both a teaching kind of mechanism, but also a way to preserve culture and pass it on in, again, in a space where you feel, right, that you're not, your own presence isn't really recognized, right? Because again, of the more, you have the dominant hegemony, if you will, of, American, so-called Anglo-American culture broadly that shapes the nation and maybe even our state. But then within a very Latino or majority minority space that is defined particularly as Chicano and Mexicano.
But I think also the fact that, you know, in Los Angeles, you also have, in the context of Guatemalans, the largest Guatemalan community outside of Guatemala is in Los Angeles, right? And if we think about, there are no hard census statistics in terms of Mayas, but, you know, estimates by both other scholars and by Maya activists is that, you know, the majority of Guatemalans in Los Angeles today are Maya, right? So one can assume that largest Maya, you know, population living outside of Guatemala, from Guatemala is in Los Angeles. So it is that hegemony, but it's also the fact that there are so many more of us here that allow us to create these sort of spaces, because this is certainly not the case, say, you know, Mayas living in Georgia or Mayas, you know, living in Postville, Iowa, right? That's very sort of different sort of conditions for them to be able to have a space, say, like the Mercado or like, you know, the radio show Contacto Ancestral. So also, you know, the large number of Guatemalans and of Mayans living here allow for those types of dynamics to take place. So you're right. In some ways, it's a way of contesting and creating a space within these different hegemonies. But it's also, I think, it's allowed or it's created because of the number of us that live in Los Angeles. So the community itself allows for that for those different articulations to happen.
Right. Karina and Esther, would you, I mean, this is kind of similar, right, for the Salvadoran community, right, being concentrated so much in Los Angeles as well, right?
I wanted to address the question of history and memory. And I think that, well, my work addresses that in the sense that history is often treated as static, as something that's static, something that is official, and something that is unchanging. And history stays in the past, so to speak. Whereas memory, and we all work with cultural memory, post-memory, etc., memory is the living presence. It is the oral cultures and it is the embodied experiences of people today as they negotiate those histories and themselves within our spaces, right? The spaces that they embody. And so in that way, I think that there is definitely a bridge between the first part, which focuses on narratives. For example, Stephen Osuna looks at the oral histories and he says the persistence, right, of those oral histories and those memories. And the second part, which is on cultural production and spatiality. And so I think that, for example, my work tries to disrupt the way that history has functioned and the way that in looking at Central America, it's been historicized in a way that, for one, we all agree is sensationalist. It's also been historicized in a way that really doesn't capture the embodied experiences of people and who we are, right, as people. And so that's what we try to emphasize with the book. And in looking at Salvadoran communities here in Los Angeles, we have to realize that we can't, right? I don't even like to say that because Los Angeles has Garifuna communities, has Guatemalan communities. Again, it is so diverse and it is so rich. And I think that what is really important for us right now at this moment is the question of TPS, the question of expulsions, and really the question of immigration, right? And how immigration is impacting our lives at this very moment as we speak. So, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Esther, because I know that, of course, with the work that you do with Edison and Yula.
No, I think what you both said about the issues of memory, that's what brought me to the space of Carecen, right? And It was, again, the fact that our histories have been submerged. They've been just even our presence as people with different types of status, right? Not recognized as refugees, not recognized as immigrants, right? Or legitimate immigrants. And I think, you know, regardless of what our own personal experience is, whether we, you know, are citizens or we were born in the US or we came as undocumented to the United States, I think that just that history of our community is so, it bears on our testimonies, it bears on our experience, it bears on everything that we are about, and also how we engage with, the public politics of the U.S., of California, or, you know, I think that that's really critical for us to consider. And I think one of the main issues that came out of our collective work in the anthology was this desire, right, to embody our experiences, but also to speak back, right? Like our presence as academics, our presence as women in the academy, our presence as members of these communities with multiple citizenships, right, is really something that we wanted to emphasize through our work. And I think that each one of the contributions really spoke to that, because our histories have not been told, not that they can be told fully because of the ways in which we were dispersed and in the ways in which we were under attack, right? And the ways in which our lives, you know, with the issue of Guatemala, right, like the genocide, with just in general, the situation that gave rise to our presence in LA, or contemporary LA, if you want to call it that. So I think I think both of you have made the points, right, that we wanted to speak back to this issue of disposability. We wanted to speak back of this issue of our legitimacy, right, as human beings, as political beings as well, right, because there's also that as part of our histories, right? What is legitimate political action within our communities is something that is also in question in many different time periods that we're dealing with. And I think, you know, this desire, right, to talk about these traces, right, like trazar la historia, right, that is, it's problematic for us because of the fact of the way we occupy space, the way that we are allowed into certain spaces, right, or like the way that we are even part of educational systems, and how our knowledge and our experience gets institutionalized within the curriculum. You know, those are the kinds of issues that we're dealing with that are interconnected, right? They're interconnected with how the histories of our communities came to be, at the epicenter, as you said, right, like of LA. And I think we also wanted to emphasize that our communities are not just add-ons. They are part of a system. And that's something that we've been in dialogue with together, right? And in argument with larger ways in which we represent Latino history and the way that we incorporate newcomers, which some of us don't see ourselves as newcomers, right? But we're constantly sort of staking our claim based on this idea of, you know, we're the newcomers. So.
Right. Well, and that point you make there on, you know, that refers to, you know, recentering, particularly, you know, broadly as it applies to Latino studies scholarship, right? And even the history of the Americas, you know, the central role that the Isthmus, particularly in that region, has played, right, in connecting the Americas, and as well as its the histories of, you know, economies and military and politics, etc. That's one of the, you know, the strong chords that comes to me throughout, you know, the narrative of the book, you know, if you want to look at it as a single narrative, which is not, it's multiple narratives, but if you want to look at it, you know, one of the central themes and arguments, right, is the imposition that, you know, Latino studies itself requires a recentering, and that experience, right, of the Central American is right there, right? It's not an addendum, you know, to this type of scholarship, or even, you know, to the broader histories of the Americas itself, but it's a way to analyze through another lens, right, and to refocus, right, and add much more, right, to what we already know, and particularly in regards to, as you're mentioning, with identities. And this is referred to in the end, you know, in the conclusion of, right, the pathways for new scholarship, right, the implications of this work to, Latino theories on citizenship, right, on politics in particular, right, on identity, with particularly, as we've mentioned so much today, with the role of indigeneity, right, within Central American populations. So thank you. I think all of you have made those things really clear. I'm about to go over time on the time that I promised you, but I wanted to give each of you a moment really quickly to share with us a little bit about, you know, your next projects or the things that you're working on now as you continue to move forward and be so productive. Who wants to start? Go ahead. You want to go first, Karina?
Sure. Well, I just, one of my most recent articles is Cultural Memory and Making by U.S. Central Americans, and it's in the Latino Studies Journal. And so I continue to look at post-memory, and I'm doing so by looking at the work of I'm not going to name the artist, but I'm looking at poetry, and I'm calling them counter-visuals, counter-poetics, and counter-narratives. And so I'm looking at novel, at poetry, and artwork. And I am looking at the way that basically the 1.5 and second generation are reimagining Central America from the vantage point of the United States. And so the type of contributions that they want to make to history and the type of recuperations that they want to make as far as our Central American stories. In looking at that, I am also looking at the way that Central American women, we play a critical role in looking at how we need to change certain aspects of our communities. And by that, I mean structurally speaking. So it is a mistake, for example, as I say, my work is progressively becoming more feminist, and more gendered focused, even though my chapter definitely in the anthology is that. But I'm looking again at this gender double consciousness. And so double consciousness is used to explain the contradictions as a racialized person, for example, right? The contradiction of knowing yourself within your community and what you represent as a person, as a human being within your community, versus the way you're typified and stereotyped and looked at, right, through the external, through the dominant lens, right? So double consciousness is that, is knowing both of those lenses, both of those perspectives, right? The embodied experience versus the typification and the stereotype, right, that is projected onto your community by dominant society. And so double consciousness approaches, you know, it's often through race, right, or through citizenship. Right, the fact that you acknowledge yourself, know yourself to be fully entitled to have full access, right, to rights, to civil rights as a human being. But double consciousness, of course, informs you that through your embodied experience that you're treated as a second-class citizen regardless, right, if at all, right? So the focus then for me is looking at gender double consciousness, which is looking at those contradictions through gender, right? Through the way we are included, excluded, through the way that we experience our communities and our cultures, through the embodied experience versus the stereotype that is projected onto us. And then, of course, a desire for us, and I think in particular for women, to want to protect.
Thank you. Or Alicia, sorry.
So I'm working on my book that focuses on the Maya diaspora in Los Angeles, specifically rooting it within the efforts of activists, Maya activists in Los Angeles, and look at multi-generations, but also looking at, these different sort of statuses in terms of, you know, people who are residents, people who are citizens, people who are undocumented, the different ways in which they contribute to creating a sense of community in Los Angeles. And of course, you know, my work is very much rooted in serving and helping in terms of the different kinds of struggles that Maya migrants in the United States, and particularly Los Angeles, face, especially right now during, you know, the movement towards, you know, disposing of so many members of our community. So, you know, some of the other work that I do is in terms of helping people become more aware of the rights and through the participation on the radio show.
Thank you. Esther?
Yes. So I'm actually kind of articulating a project because I'm about to start it. And I'm looking at migration of Salvadorans to other states. So I think I'm going to be doing some interviews with people who are moving out of LA and sort of kind of what that experience of migration, you know, like new migrations is about. And that comes from our own communities because our communities are moving all over the place. And I have been sort of interested in that topic of people moving to Utah, people moving to Texas, and even a small community in Oregon. So I'm kind of interested in looking at that. And the second part of that, sort of like to look at that experience of our migrations, is people returning home. And so I think that's my next project. I'm, you know, first going to start with people who are moving out of California and moving to other states. And then sort of like the reality that a lot of people are going either voluntarily back home, right, or they're being deported. So I'm interested in sort of looking at, you know, migration multidimensionally, because migration has been an experience for our communities. You know, growing up, we had people moving to Panama, moving to Honduras and Guatemala. And so I think, you know, we again are at that moment, right, of people kind of looking for opportunities in new places. And that's what my next project is going to be about, the new movements.
Right. Well, thanks to all three of you, you know, for joining me on the podcast. I appreciate your time. I'm so grateful to have this out. I'm glad to hear it's in its second printing, and it'll continue to do well, I'm sure, and look forward to your scholarship as it continues to come out. So best of luck to all of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the producer and host of today's podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with Karina O. Alvarado, Alicia Yvonne Estrada, and Esther E. Hernandez, co-editors of U.S. Central Americans, Reconstructing Memories, Struggles, and Communities of Resistance, published by the University of Arizona Press in 2017. As always, I invite you to like and follow our social media pages on Twitter and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and we appreciate your feedback.